All right, good afternoon. 5241, and it's Wednesday, August 20th, and this is our second session. We're going to finish up chapter one, move on to chapter two today. Some of you have had labs, some of you haven't, some of you have taken the pre-test in here. If not, maybe some of you have to take it on Friday, and unfortunately it's all kind of messed up already because you're way too educated to take the pre-test if your lab isn't until Friday, but that's okay. And it won't count toward your grade at all. It's just going to help make instruction in the class better. It's called a slow cat evaluation. It's for teachers more than for students. All right, so last time we first introduced you to our supplemental instruction leader, Lynn Selden, who is right here, and I want her to say a couple words again because I think she's looking for some pieces of paper from you guys today. Okay, so who needs the weekly study plan? Y'all have that? You know where to download it off the internet? You should be working on that, filling it in, keeping track, so you can talk to your lab instructor and me about it, right, to optimize your studying. Here is a sign-in sheet for today. Sign that, pass it around. Here is a syllabus for Bio 241. I believe that's his class. 2 to 320. You can take one, pass it back, pass it sideways a little bit. Make sure I've got a couple more copies up over here. I did not have that last time. But I do now. Extras, just maybe pass. Oh yeah, just pass them back that way. They're the same. Yeah, just keep passing them around till everybody's got them. Okay, I also have the slides from Lecture 1. If you didn't download those, you might want to get a copy of Lecture 1. Take one, pass it sideways, pass it backwards. That's Lecture 1. And I also have Lecture Number 2, but maybe I won't pass those back right away because they'll just get all mixed up. But before I start, in just a couple minutes, I'll pass out Lecture Number 2. And these are the only hard copies that I'll pass out in lecture. So if you like the format of these slides right here to take notes on, then please go to Blackboard and print them out for yourselves or load them into your computer or whatever you would like to do with them. Okay? Okay. Any questions over last time? Any questions? All right, I got some questions then. See, it's always best to ask me questions. That way I don't ask you questions. But actually, it's good that I ask you questions. But somebody did have a question. Somebody had a question about the book, the textbook. Somebody had a different author of Human Physiology. It was a Vanders Human Physiology, not by Fox. That's a good textbook. We used to use that one here. But students' comments about that book was that it was way too high level and it was very difficult to understand when you were trying to read it. So we switched textbooks and went to Fox, which is easier to read. So the question is, can they use Vanders? And the textbooks really are different. The material that's covered is different. And when I put something on the test, you're responsible for exam figures. So I might photocopy a figure out of the Fox textbook and put it on the test. And if you don't study that figure, then you're not going to be as prepared as somebody that does. So if you use a different textbook by Vanders, for instance, you're not going to have the right figures. You're not going to have the right end of chapter questions. So you'll be at a big disadvantage. I don't recommend using a different author, although the material, and physiology is a lot different than anatomy. Anatomy hasn't changed in tens of thousands of years, right? But physiology, our understanding of physiology changes almost every week. So different textbooks and new textbooks in physiology are a lot different than they were even a couple of years ago. So it's best to just get the most current edition of the author that I have on the syllabus, and that will help you out the most. And follow the study guide that's on the internet for this particular text, and you guys should do really well in the class, okay? Say that again?
No.
Okay, yeah. So the sooner you start studying, the better for that, right? All right, so now does anybody have any questions regarding what we're talking about? No, that's right, you already gave up your chance to ask a question. So I'll ask you a question. What's the, a lot of times we like to learn a lot of details about something and we lose sight of the big picture, but it's really important to see the big picture, understand the big picture all the time. And I told you about the steps of the scientific method and blah, 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 blah. But I would like for you to know, why should you appreciate all the steps of the scientific method? And furthermore, why should anybody care to go through that whole big, long process? What's the use of using the scientific method in your lives? Why are you interested in knowing something about scientific method?
Credibility.
That's right. I would say that's a really good, important thing, because what the scientific method gives us is reliable information, right? Information you can count on to be true. So that's the whole purpose of the scientific method. That's the purpose of all those steps. Because anybody can tell you information, but who knows if it's worthwhile or not, right? I can tell you the score of a baseball game tonight. I could just make it up and you could place a $10,000 bet on the score of that baseball game, but that's not reliable information. Right? You're probably going to be wasting your money. Things that go through the scientific method you can bet on, and it's not going to cost you your life or a lot of money. Okay? So that's the purpose of the scientific method. We talked about homeostasis. So does anybody have a good idea what homeostasis is all about? What is homeostasis? Something happening inside your body. It's how your body regulates itself. So all the physiologic parameters inside your body are doing what? Are they changing? Or are they... Okay. See, it's a little bit of a complicated concept. They're not absolutely constant. They're fluctuating and changing a little bit, but only within a narrow range. Right? So physiologic parameters are all dancing around each other, changing, adjusting, and compensating for other little changes that are happening inside your body. So homeostasis is a way for your body to make little changes of all these important physiological parameters such that you're able to sustain your life. Right? So that's what homeostasis is all about. And there are two kinds of feedbacks, right? The negative and positive feedback. Which is the one that leads to a healthy state? Negative feedback. And the one that leads to a decompensated, unhealthy state is positive feedback. And how can you remember that? What's a good way of remembering that? The best way to visualize that is to think of a response loop, okay? And how does a response loop always start? It always starts with a stimulus, and how does a response loop always end? With a response, right? So if the response adds to the stimulus, what kind of feedback is that? That's a positive feedback, right? If your body temperature goes up and the response is to make your temperature higher, that's positive feedback, leads to a disease state. But if the response subtracts from the stimulus, what kind of feedback is that? Negative, right? So that's a really nice way to understand positive and negative feedback. So for instance, negative feedback works, for instance, if your body temperature increases, response is to decrease it back to, what's that? What is that thing that we talk about? The set point, the normal, right, the value that is absolutely normal, Okay, it goes back to the set point. Okay, so that's important things about feedback. We kind of covered all this stuff already, but I don't know if we covered this slide right here. Instead of temperature, this is talking about blood pressure. And maybe I talked about this a little bit already. For instance, your blood pressure is changing all the time, depending on what your body position is and level of stress and time of day and all that kind of stuff. But blood pressure, high blood pressure called hypertension, is a very deadly disease, and it affects many, many, many people all over the world. So you should be a little familiar with hypertension. And what is the set point for blood pressure? You all should pretty much know a good normal number for blood pressure. Okay? And you tell me two numbers. Yeah, how come there's two numbers? How come there's just not one number? Okay, because we're going to learn why later in the class. But you're right, there are actually two numbers. Your blood pressure goes up when your heart contracts, and your blood pressure goes down when it's relaxing. Right, so there's really two numbers. The first number is what we call the systolic blood pressure number. That's when your heart is contracting. That's the maximum. The second number is diastolic pressure, when your heart is relaxing and filling with blood. Welcome. All right, so there are actually two numbers that we use to talk about blood pressure, systolic over diastolic pressure. And the normal, what's a good normal blood pressure that everybody should have? 120 over 80, that's right. And a lot of people talk about which number is more important, blah, 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 or you average them together, what's important. But actually, both numbers should be 120 over 80 or below. That's very healthy, okay? So that would be, those numbers then are what we call the what? The set point for blood pressure. And that information is, where is the set point located, even for blood pressure? In terms of a response loop, where is the set point located? And you might actually have to look in the PowerPoints that you get in lab. So if you haven't had lab yet, you're at a little disadvantage, but we're going to yak about it anyway. The set point is in the integration center. All right, and the integration center, in this particular for blood pressure, is in the medulla oblongata, and you all know where the medulla oblongata is. Okay. But in order for this medulla oblongata right here to be able to compare an actual blood pressure with the set point, sorry about that. Okay, now I have my arrow forever. In order for this integration center to see if there is an error between the set point and what your blood pressure actually is, how does it get that information? How does it know what your actual blood pressure is? Or how do you know that I have the lights on in here? You have to have a receptor or a sensor, right? You know the lights are on in here because you have photoreceptors. Your body knows what blood pressure you are at because you have pressure sensors, and those pressure sensors are what we call baroreceptors. We're going to learn where they are in your body. So the stimulus is a change in blood pressure. Okay, so in this particular condition, a person is lying down at rest. They stand up. And when you stand up, your blood pressure will fall. As a matter of fact, sometimes a person's blood pressure decreases so much and so rapidly that they lose consciousness. That's really not a good thing, right? They pass out, because then what happens? Well, you might hit your head on the table, and then it's going to bounce off the table, hit the chair, and bounce off the chair and hit the floor, that kind of stuff, right? So it's really, it's rude. So it's good to be able to maintain your blood pressure when you change your body position. So as somebody stands up, their blood pressure falls because they're changing their body position. And the baroreceptors monitor that decrease in blood pressure. Right? So the receptors sense that. And it sends the signal to the medulla oblongata via what? Afferent pathway, or sensory nerve fibers. Afferent and sensory are exactly the same. Hopefully you learned that in anatomy. Who learned that in anatomy? Anybody? Yeah, all right, good. Okay. All right, to the medulla, and the medulla is the integration center. So what resides in the integration center? The set point, and it's going to take the actual measurement compared to the set point. If there's an error, the integration center has got to come up with a decision on what to do. And in this particular case, the blood pressure is too low, so it's going to send signals to a number of places, but one place in particular is going to go to the heart via what? Efferent or motor fibers. And what do you think the effect on the heart is going to be? Slow down or speed up? It's going to speed up, right? The heart rate is going to increase, but the force of contraction is also going to increase. So both what we call the chronotropic effect, that means the heart rate, and the inotropic effect on the heart, the force of contraction will increase. So the heart is going to pump more blood at a higher pressure, which raises the pressure. So the heart, in this case, is the effector, and a rise in blood pressure is what? A stimulus, a response, or what? That's a response. Yeah, that's a response. And in this particular case, what was the stimulus? A decrease in blood pressure. The response is an increase. How do they join together? Do they add or subtract from each other? They subtract. So this is a good example of which kind of feedback? Negative feedback. Maintaining homeostasis so this person doesn't pass out. Okay, so this is a nice perfect example of homeostasis and how it helps regulate blood pressure. Okay, so that's a nice slide. We can also compare this to other kinds of control systems. For instance, our body regulates blood glucose because blood glucose is important for generating ATP, which is the energy source for our bodies. And so cells have to have glucose so that they can make ATP. And depending on different states that we're in, we might have more or less levels of glucose in our blood, but we have to regulate it somehow. If we lose the ability to regulate blood glucose, what disease process do we call that? That's diabetes mellitus in particular. And we even know now there are different forms of diabetes mellitus, and we're going to talk about all that and why it is, at least the understanding currently that we have. All right, so let's look at regulation of blood glucose for a little bit. So for instance, what do you think happens to blood glucose after a meal when you're in a state that we call a fed state? When you're in a fed state, what happens? That's right, because where is it, all that glucose coming from? All the food that you ate, from your intestines, right? They're absorbing glucose, and it's taking that glucose, putting it in your blood. Your blood glucose is going up. Okay, when that happens, the pancreas has receptors for glucose. At least certain cells of the pancreas do. And as a result of increased blood glucose, these cells are going to release a hormone called insulin into the blood. It's going to go everywhere in the body. And insulin is a passport. It lets glucose into cells. Without insulin, right, cells cannot take up glucose. Even though there's plenty of glucose in the blood, if there's a cell that's in your body without insulin, they're going to starve to death. Okay, it's really kind of a terrible thing about diabetes. Glucose can't get into cells without that passport, which is called insulin. So the pancreas releases insulin, so all the cells, all those trillions of cells in your body now can take up glucose from the blood. So we have increased cellular glucose. So as glucose gets taken out of the blood into the cells, what happens to the level of glucose in your blood? It drops, right? It can't stay the same because cells are taking it up, right? And so there we see decreased blood glucose. Now, what was the initial stimulus for this response loop? Increase in blood glucose, response is decrease. How do these join together, the stimulus and the response? They subtract from each other, so this is another example of a negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so this is what we call a fed state. When you're in a fasted state, your gastrointestinal tract is not allowing you to absorb glucose, right? So your blood glucose is going to have a tendency to decrease because your cells are using it. Again, the pancreas can monitor. There are receptors for glucose in the pancreas, at least in some of the cells, and the pancreas not only can release insulin, but another important hormone, which probably you have not heard of, but we'll talk about quite a bit in this particular class. Insulin works together with glucagon. All right, so if blood glucose is decreasing, should the pancreas secrete a lot of insulin? What's the effect of insulin? Decreasing blood glucose. So if blood glucose is already low, it doesn't make sense to decrease blood glucose any further by having the surge in insulin, right? That would be counterproductive. That would actually be harmful. But what your pancreas does, it secretes a different hormone called glucagon. And glucagon is in the blood, travels everywhere in the body, and it tells cells, well, actually, this decrease in insulin stops cells from taking up glucose from the blood. And glucagon in particular goes to the liver, and it tells the liver to release glucose. So there are stores of glucose in the liver that are held there in reserve for when you are in the fasted state so that it can maintain blood glucose. So the liver secretes glucose into the blood, and when it does so, what happens to blood glucose levels? They increase. What was the initial stimulus? A decrease. And so the stimulus is subtracted from the response, so that's another nice negative feedback loop. So this is a nice normal circumstance that is maintaining what in this body? Homeostasis, right? That's maintaining homeostasis. So in this loop right here, you see a lot of things changing. Homeostasis doesn't mean that everything is absolutely constant. It means what? Everything is changing and adjusting so that blood glucose doesn't change very much, because you can go into coma and death if it changes drastically. Okay? Okay. But I don't have any positive feedback on this slide. Okay, a couple other details in this chapter, some definitions. Stem cell. A stem cell is a kind of cell that is what we call undifferentiated. For instance, how many different kinds of tissues do you have in your body? The major kinds. How many major kinds of tissues? It's really simple. There's only four kinds, right? There's epithelium, connective, muscle, and nerve. Those are the only four. All right. A stem cell is a kind of cell that can become any one of those particular kind of tissues. And a zygote is what we call totipotent. What the heck is a zygote? Does anybody know what a zygote is? Sounds really funny, but we were all one at one time. Okay? If you have a little brother or sister at home, you could call them a zygote when you get mad at them. What is a zygote? A zygote is just a single cell. And it's the product of an egg being united with a sperm. Okay? Right after fertilization, you have a zygote, just a single cell. And that single cell can become what? Well, it becomes you, and you have all the tissues of a human, right? So a zygote has the potential to be any kind of tissue. It's what we call undifferentiated. A zygote, when it undergoes mitosis, it can differentiate into muscle or nerve or epithelium or connective tissue. It can become any kind of tissue. So we call that totipotent. There are some, as a zygote grows, when it splits into two cells and four and eight, 16 and 32 cells, right, then some of those cells lose the ability to become any tissue, right? But they can still become maybe a number of different kinds of tissues, but not just any one. And in that particular case, we call that an embryonic stem cell. Right, those are pluripotent cells. They can't become any kind of tissue, but maybe a range of some tissues. So they're still pretty, they still are to some degree undifferentiated. All right, and then we have adult stem cells. We call these multipotent, and these can hardly become many different kinds of tissues, maybe different kinds of cell lines, like there are different kinds of cells in blood. So a multipotent adult stem cell can maybe become different kinds of blood cells, but they still can't differentiate from a blood cell to, say, muscle or nerve or something like that. All right, so these are just different degrees. Totipotent means what? The greatest degree of variability. Can become anything. Pluripotent means almost everything, but not quite. Multipotent means only a few different kinds of cell types. All right, so one kind of cell that's very nice to work with to develop a number of different tissues are these embryonic stem cells. Okay, so for instance, if we wish to develop some cell lines to help somebody's, maybe somebody's pancreas doesn't have the cells to produce insulin anymore and they have diabetes. Maybe we could get some cells to produce those cells from the pancreas and then graft them to somebody that has diabetes and they could be cured of diabetes. That's a really nice technique, right? If we could do that. We can't do that just yet. But when we take stem cells from an embryo, a human embryo, guess what happens to the embryo? It's killed. Okay, you can't take stem cells from an embryo and have the embryo survive. And obviously those cells are alive, right? Because you wouldn't be interested in harvesting dead cells. And what kind of live cells are those? Are those like from a turtle or a human? Right? So those are human cells from a human, and it's a big discussion, is that really an individual or not? But nonetheless, right, it's killing whatever that thing is. And so that's where the ethical problems come from in embryonic stem cell research. There's a lot of potential good that could be gained from that activity, but you know, you're doing something with human life right there, and some people are really object to that kind of manipulation and experimentation. Okay? Okay, but maybe a lot of that is going to go away, that controversy, because in all of us adults, there are stem cells. We just don't know where all of them exist for all the different kinds of tissues. And maybe all the tissues don't have stem cells, but then again, I got a feeling that there are stem cells pretty much in our body in all different locations. We just haven't learned where they are yet. So I suspect that this debate about embryonic stem cells is probably going to disappear over time. Okay, so where do we know that have stem cells? Well, for instance, somebody had a good guess where stem cells could be?
No.
Oh, you know, there are some interesting things in the nose for sure, because we have thought for a long time that nerve cells, okay, you're born with all the nerve cells that you're ever going to have, and if any die, then you're going to live the rest of your life with fewer nerve cells than what you maybe should have. But we have learned that in the nose, there are some nerves that actually start in the brain and end up in your nasal cavity. They're just dangling out in space, right out in the environment. It's really weird. It's really weird for you to have nerves just hanging out in, right, in space someplace. And because they're just hanging out like that, they don't live very long, because you breathe hot air, they get hot, and breathe cold air, they get really cold air, they could get frozen, chemicals in your nose, right, they get burned and things like that. So there are stem cells in your nose that replace those olfactory nerve fibers fairly often. So that's really interesting from a number of different points. So it'd be really fun, I think, to take some nerve cells from somebody's nose, culture them, transplant it to somebody that has a spinal cord injury, and have those nerve cells rebuild their spinal cord. That'd be really cool. But their back might then smell. I don't know. They would not be able to smell with their back. Okay, I'm just kind of kidding with that. I don't really know about that, but that's probably a nice tack that we could do in research. So we're learning more and more where stem cells are. Also, on a hair follicle, we found that there are stem cells right here on this bulge of a hair follicle. And why is this going to be really crucial? We've known this for quite a while in terms of certain kinds of injuries. Like, what kind of injuries is this really important information? Like for burns, right? When somebody gets a third-degree burn and they lose their skin, and these cells then can be used to hopefully repopulate their integument, right, after a burn, after some kind of injury. Because right now, if somebody has a burn all the way down to the bottom of a hair follicle, see, this is all epithelium here. So it's a reservoir of cells, epithelial cells. So if you have a burn that doesn't burn all the way down to the bottom of a hair follicle, that these cells can repopulate that part of a person's skin. But if they have a third degree burn all the way down, then that part of their body can never regenerate, because all of those epithelial cells are gone. But if there's a hair follicle someplace on their body, these cells can be harvested, can be grown, and then can be grafted onto their person, and they can regrow their skin from what? Their own cells. That's really nice, because then they don't have to take anti-rejection medication, right? Because it's their own cells. It won't be rejected. So that's pretty cool. So that's another thing about stem cells, is that you can autograft. You can take cells from your own body and you sidestep all those complications of the immune system. Okay, let's go back to this one right here. So stem cells, most organs in your body are what we call highly differentiated. They have acquired a certain structure and a certain function, and that's how they have to live out their life. A muscle cell is specialized to contract, and that's all they're going to be. They can never go backwards. They can never undifferentiate, become a stem cell, and then become a nerve cell, for instance. So differentiation is what we call an irreversible process, at least at our level of medicine at the moment, right? We can't undifferentiate a cell. All right, and adults themselves are differentiated, but they still can become other kinds of cells, right? And we'll be learning more and more about that as time goes on. Okay, one last thing. So stem cell, we got stem right here. What can it do? It can become muscle, right? Yeah, connective tissue. It can be what? Nerve, nervous tissue, and epithelium, right? And is this a two-way street? Can't go back. It's irreversible, right? Epithelium. Okay, and what are these, well, what's the name of the process that these arrows represent? That's called differentiation. The arrows are what we call differentiation, and that's a stem cell. There's another kind of cell. People use these two terms interchangeably, and I don't know why we haven't settled on, as a community, a uniform language, but I would like to tell you how I think it's probably going to go. There's another kind of cell, right here, that's going to, okay, so this process we call differentiation, and this is basically by mitosis. It's a special kind of mitosis, right? When we have this cell forming a, what does that look like? That's a sperm cell, okay? So the genetic material in this cell is a lot different than this one. As a matter of fact, does anybody know how many chromosomes are in a normal human cell? Probably. Okay? There's 46 altogether, but two special sets. There's 1 through 23 over here, and then another different set, 1 through 23 over here. So maybe this first one over here you get from your mom, and this other set over here you get from your dad. So I'm going to put a P over here, because M stands for maternal, and P stands for paternal, okay, but it's really mom and dad. So you're made up of half your mom, half your dad's chromosomes. But this sperm over here, how many chromosomes are in this sperm? There's only 23. You know, it's going to be a couple from over here and a couple from over here, hopefully no duplicates. So there's just going to be one set. And that set is going to be from both, some combination of the mom and dad, 1 through 23. Okay, so that's a special kind of process. A lot of times, people call this a stem cell. All right, but it's not. That's not a stem cell. Oh, does anybody know what this cell is called before I get to that one? This, okay, you have a sperm in males, or an egg in females, or oocyte. This is what we call a gamete. That's a special cell. Okay, that's a gamete. It's going to relate to a zygote in just a second. So cells that can produce gametes really aren't stem cells. It's used a lot in literature that way. But these right here, these cells really are what we should call germ cells. Okay, that's a germ cell. The concept of germination is like growing a life form. This is a germ cell. So when germ cells undergo, oh, what's the name of this arrow, this process? This is meiosis. All right, so meiosis will convert germ cells into gametes. And at the right time, we can have another kind of gamete over here. Right, and let's call this an egg. That's another kind of gamete. How many chromosomes are going to be in this gamete right here, this egg? Yeah, it's going to be 1 through 23. Again, because this egg is produced by meiosis in a different individual. And when we put a sperm and an egg together, we get a single cell over here. And we talked about what this single cell is called. This is a zygote. All right, and now you got what? Two whole sets of chromosomes again? And I don't know if I'll put this question on the test, but it's a good question. What is this process of these two arrows coming together? You've all known that like 15 years ago, but I'll ask you. What's that called? That's fertilization. Yeah, that's fertilization. All right, so that's kind of a little scheme. So stem cells are undifferentiated cells. Germ cells produce gametes. That's just some terminology you should be familiar with, just to be familiar with current contents of things that people are really interested in today. Okay, body fluid compartments. Here's another topic that I guess we don't really know where to put in the textbook, so we just kind of throw it in on the first chapter. And so the body has an intracellular compartment and an extracellular. Intracellular means what? Inside the cell. And extracellular means outside the cell. And furthermore, probably you should know that inside the cell, how can we talk about compartments inside the cell? What do we call that, all that junk inside of a cell? Well, I guess we're going to talk about that maybe in a couple chapters. We'll get to it. That's called cytoplasm, right? Cytoplasm is all the living stuff inside of a cell. And cytoplasm has two parts. It has organelles and cytosol. When we get to cells, we'll really look at that again. So I probably shouldn't spend too much time talking about that. Okay. The extracellular compartment is actually composed of two other compartments. The fluid that is outside of your circulatory system but surrounding every cell. It's not inside the cell, it's just surrounding every cell, but it's not in your bloodstream. We call that interstitial fluid. So there is interstitial fluid on the outside of the cells, and it's flowing around the cells, and it's bringing nutrients and washing away waste products and things like that. So there's a flow of fluid around a lot of cells in your body. All right, and the other fluid compartment that's in your body, we don't call it interstitial, but it's the fluid that's in your cardiovascular system. Right? It's fluid that is inside blood vessels and inside the heart. It's the fluid part of blood. And the fluid part of blood is what we call, on the board right there, that's what we call plasma. So blood has two parts to it. The first part are the thing, our cells. We call those formed elements. And the second part of blood is what we call plasma, things that's dissolved in blood that's not cellular. Okay, so you have interstitial fluid and blood plasma as being extracellular compartments. And when people are real serious about monitoring and taking care of a patient, they're interested in all of these different compartments of fluid in your body because they all interact with each other. And we'll look at some of that in this class. All right, so that's the last slide for here. Any questions on this stuff? Just kind of a lot of definitions. Okay? Okay. All right, so chapter 2. And everybody's got, I think, a handout for chapter 2. Oh, I didn't hand it. Oh, I said I was going to hand it out later. Okay. Okay. I've got more, so I'll be back in just a second. Yeah. Yeah? Germ cell. A germ cell. All right, sorry, I didn't get another black one. A germ cell is a cell that can produce gametes. So, for instance, in the testes, inside the seminiferous tubules, there are germ cells that are always undergoing meiosis to produce gametes. So that's a germ cell. It's something that can produce a gamete. Okay? So it's not really a germ. Yeah, I got to get them up there this weekend. Good question. All right. Yeah, just pass those back. I have, if somebody needs a lecture too, I'll put them on the corner of this desk right here and you can come on down. But you probably have plenty to go around. Okay. So this is what, the last handout of the PowerPoint slide. So if you like them, you got to help yourself. Unless you, and they're on Blackboard. Okay. Okay. Okay, so chapter 2. What do we got for chapter 2? Chemistry. Yeah, chemistry. Okay. And so chemistry is a very important fundamental building block of the human body. So you can't have an understanding of pH. You can't have an understanding of how we regulate blood pressure and fluid compartments in our body without knowing something about chemistry. As a matter of fact, you can't even understand anything about nerve conduction or how information goes from one nerve to another across a synapse without knowing some chemistry and knowing something about ions. Okay, so we're going to develop a nice understanding of some of these things. All right. Okay, so here are some things we're going to look at. We're going to even look at some basic properties of an atom. We're not going to really get into too much physics, but just a little understanding of an atom. All right, we're going to look at some chemical bonds. We're going to understand four kinds of chemical bonds, how they develop, what kind of relative strength they have. Some chemical bonds are real strong. They're hard to break. Others are real easy to break because they're weak. So things you like to put together and break apart easily, you use a very weak bond. Structures that you want to have a lot of integrity, you don't want breaking apart, you're going to use strong chemical bonds for, like hair, okay, has strong chemical bonds in it. So we've got to learn something about bonds. And of course, acids and bases, we got to understand what an acid and a base is and something about the pH scale. And then we're going to look at four different kinds of organic molecules that are important biologically. So we have to come up with a definition for what an organic molecule is. And there are other important biochemicals in our body, okay, but they're such small concentrations that we don't mention them with these four important types right here, like carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. So when we look at these, probably one of the most important things is to know what their building block is. And you could probably already tell me what the building block of a protein is. What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid, right. Okay, so we're going to learn the building blocks of all of these biochemicals. All right, but we're going to start off small and get big. So we're going to start with an atom. So here we have an atom right here. This is the smallest unit of a chemical element, right? There, and an atom is composed of three basic subatomic particles that we have to know a little bit about, and those particles are protons, electrons, and neutrons. And if we look at, let's look at this nice illustration right here of an atom. An atom has basically two parts. There's a center part right here, which we call the nucleus. And what did I say about terminology in here? Sometimes a structure might have a number of different names, but the converse of that is true. And that is, different things might have the same name. So here is the center of an atom that we call a nucleus, but does this nucleus have anything to do with the nucleus inside of a cell? No. Okay, two totally different things. Okay, so here the nucleus inside of an atom, it's so microscopic you can't see it with any kind of microscope at all, right? It's very, very tiny. This particle right here is so tiny, we just kind of know it's there from kind of sophisticated experiments. So this is the nucleus, and then outside the nucleus is what we call an orbital. So maybe in your mind you could have a picture of our solar system with the sun on the inside and where are the planets? Like planet Earth is in an orbit around the sun. It's kind of an imperfect model when you get into advanced chemistry, but I think this is a good place to start. The nucleus would be like the sun, and this particle right here would be like a planet circling around the sun. And the planets, where do we find these planets in this atomic model right here? Not in the nucleus, but in an orbital, right? In an orbital. So in the nucleus, we can have two of these three particles are allowed to go into the nucleus. There are protons that can be in the nucleus and neutrons. The third particle has to be in an orbital. And what's the third particle called?
Electron.
So you got to know what part of an atom these particles can be in. The other thing that you should know is that a proton has a positive charge. So it has electrical charge, and it is exactly one. And an electron has an electrical charge, and it is exactly opposite a proton. So it's going to be negative. So all the positive charges we find inside the nucleus, negative charges we find in, where do we find negative charges?
Orbitals,
right. And there can be a number of different orbitals depending on how many electrons that particular atom has, right? So this one right here is just the first orbital. Okay, and a neutron has no charge. It is neutral, therefore we call it a neutron. All right, now the funny thing about these charged particles is how they like to interact with each other, how they like to associate with each other. So it just so happens that opposite charges attract each other and like charges repel each other. So you might wonder, well, if we put a bunch of protons inside the nucleus, those are all like charges, how do you get them in there? Because they like to repel each other. They want to combine with the electrons. And the answer to that is, in a simple form, is that when we put a lot of protons inside the nucleus, the only way that we can get them all to coexist is by putting little separations between them, and those little separations are neutrons. So you got to put neutrons inside the nucleus, otherwise all those protons are going to fly out of the nucleus. And that would be really dangerous, okay, when matter flies apart like that. That would be like a radioactive particle. Okay. All right, so here we have this first element right here is what we call hydrogen. How many particles do you see inside the nucleus?
One.
Just one. And it would be really nice if they had a little plus symbol right there. You could put a plus symbol in there because that is a proton. And the second diagram down over here, we see inside the nucleus some of these, which one is it? Is it this one right here? Or is it the dark one?
One
right here?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a proton right here. These darker ones are neutrons, right? And so we find neutrons and protons inside the nucleus, and if we count the protons, we see that it has six. And in this particular case, it's got six neutrons as well. And this atom is going to be neutral. Since it has six protons inside the nucleus, how many electrons does it need to have in orbitals? It's got to have six as well to be neutral. All right, and that means it's going to be relatively stable. So I see six electrons that are in orbitals around this particular atom. Oh, here's the key right here. All right, here's a neutron, here's a proton. Ah, good. And there's a little electron. Okay, so these are what we call different elements. And there are a number of different elements, and in this, I think your slides, let's see if I put it in your slide set. Did I give you a table of elements that you have to know? That's not in your book. Yes, that one right there. I stole it from a book. It's element and their symbols. Elements and their symbols. Okay, on this chart right over here, these are all the elements that are naturally occurring and even some man-made ones right here. All right, and actually I will probably give you this on the test. And you see that, okay, we don't really care so much about these elements down over here anyway, okay. But notice that these element names are really long, like potassium is really long. So we come up with abbreviations, and we make it a one-letter or two-letter abbreviation for these chemical elements. Like, for instance, here is potassium. And the chemical symbol for potassium is not P, it is K, right? So the ones you have to know are right here on this table. Okay, so you don't have to memorize the periodic table, but you got to be a little familiar with it. So what makes potassium different than sodium? Some of you might know this, but we got to cover a lot of the nice basics, okay? Yes, potassium is a K and sodium is an Na. All right, but the real reason is because of the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. The number of protons inside the nucleus completely determines what kind of element it is, whether it's a hydrogen or a helium, which is not important to us except in parties, potassium, sodium, calcium, magnesium, things like that. So each different element will have a different number of protons inside the nucleus. And this table will tell you how many protons are inside the nucleus. We call that the atomic number. Right, the atomic number. So number one over here, you see number one right there, maybe even in the back of the room. This element, which is H, what does H stand for? Hydrogen has one proton. The next element, we have to go over here, is helium. And how many protons are in the nucleus of a helium? It tells you right there, two. And then the next one is lithium. Okay, it's got three. That's not so important biologically for us. But carbon is, okay, how many protons in the nucleus of a carbon? Six. You don't have to memorize that because I'll give that to you on the test. Right? I'm going to give you a periodic table. But what I'm going to erase on the test is, all right, the word. So this one right here, Ca stands for calcium. I'm going to give you a periodic table, and it's just going to have Ca, and I might ask you, well, what does Ca stand for? And I might ask you, how many protons are in the nucleus of calcium? And calcium is not going to be on the periodic table, so you got to know calcium is Ca, and then you got to read the periodic table. You could answer that right now. How many protons are in the nucleus of a calcium? 20. Okay, and you'll see why that's important to know that in just a little bit. All right, so that's the list. Some of it is really obvious, like O stands for oxygen. Yeah? You have to know that Ca stands for calcium, and that 20 right there will be on the handout. Okay? But you got to know what the 20 means.
Right.
Okay?
But we don't have to memorize all
you don't have to know that. The only thing you have to know is the first two columns on that table right there. The chemical symbol and the chemical name. That's going to be on the piece of paper that I give you if you know what? That's what that little number stands for. Not that number, not that number. Not that number, any other number. It's this one right up over here. And what did we call that number? Atomic number. So every element is different because why? It has a different number of photons inside the nucleus, not in orbitals. Right? Okay. So that's some fundamental chemistry. And maybe you'll appreciate a little organization of that periodic table as we go through the class. It's not important, but I at least want you to know about atomic number, because that's going to be important to know how ions develop, why we are electrical beings, okay? Because this helps produce electricity in our body, electrical properties inside our body. Okay, I think I covered everything on this slide, right? Anybody got a question on this slide? Orbitals, what's in orbitals? Electrons, what's the charge of an electron? Minus one, where are protons inside the nucleus, right?
They have to be all equal amount of the compact, like proton, neutron, electron to keep stability?
Not necessarily. Some atoms need a lot more neutrons than the number of protons. Like uranium, for instance, needs a lot more neutrons, okay, because it will break apart. Like uranium-242 can break apart. It will kick particles out. And that's radioactivity. It's high energy, very damaging. Hopefully we learn how to harness that energy to generate electricity and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So you got to learn that kind of stuff in a chemistry or physics class. It's really cool. But you want to hear something weird that doesn't pertain to this class, but it's kind of interesting? So when the universe began, okay, the only elements that formed was hydrogen. Not all of these other complicated ones with more and more protons on the inside. How did all these other elements come to be? There's only one process that can create all these different elements. It's sort of magic. It's when a star gets really, really old, okay, and it goes into supernova and explodes, it can create these more complicated elements. So all these elements that we have in our bodies, like carbon and potassium, came from where? A star that supernova, billions of years ago. That's kind of freaky. And they all came back together to form another solar system and all that kind of stuff. But that's beyond physiology. Okay. So I get a lot of questions. Well, where did we come from? And the basic statement is what? Well, we had to come from a supernova sometime way back in our past. Okay. All right, so atomic number is what I'm interested in. Atomic mass, I'm not so interested in. It's more, That is just the number of protons plus neutrons. That's not too important for this class. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about orbitals. There's another name for an orbital, and sometimes it's called a shell. And where do you find shells again? Outside the nucleus, those electrons floating around over there. Okay, and I said there can be a number of shells depending on how many electrons an atom has, and that's determined primarily by the number of protons inside the nucleus, which means it's determined by exactly what kind of element it is. All right, so here are some rules, and usually I don't have you memorize rules that are numerical in nature, but this is a pretty good rule I think you have to just memorize. The first shell can only handle 2 electrons, no more than that. So if there is an atom like what, lithium, that has 3 protons, it has 3 electrons, it can only put the first 2 in the first orbital, and then the third one has to be bumped out to a farther orbital, in the second orbital. And in the second orbital, we can have as many as 8 electrons. And then if an atom has more than 8, 9, 10 electrons, then the next electrons have to go into the third orbital. All right, so every orbital after the first one can have 8 electrons in it. And you might actually see that on this periodic table over here. What is the first row? How many elements do we have in the first row? We only have 2, because that signifies that first orbital can only have 2 electrons. So look at this second row over here. How many elements are there? There are 8, because the second orbital can actually have 8 electrons in it. So there's really a nice method to the arrangement of this periodic table, but that's sort of beyond the course. But that, you might see some symmetry and some structure in the periodic table that might help you on a test. Okay. 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 Electrons in more distant shells, that's not so important for this class either. But first shell, 2 electrons. Second and subsequent shells can have 8 altogether. Okay. The ones that are in the outermost shell are what we call the valence electrons. And those are going to be the ones that we're most interested in this class, because those are the electrons, the valence electrons, that allow chemistry to take place. So chemistry is all about understanding how electrons in the valence shell, the outermost shell, interact with other elements. That's basically chemistry. And so chemical reactions are the interaction of different atoms coming together and doing something with those electrons that are in the outermost shell. An isotope, this is sort of interesting, I won't test you on this, but an isotope is a same kind of element, but will have, it's a, all the same atom, but will have a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus. It will have the same number of protons, right, but a different number of neutrons, so it's got to be the same element, but just a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus. If you're interested in that, maybe see me after class or something. Maybe some of you have heard of deuterium. Deuterium is a hydrogen atom that has a neutron in it. So it's still hydrogen because it only has 1 proton, but it's got a neutron in there as well. So we call that deuterium. Yeah. Okay. Oh, here's that nice table. So this is what you got to know. What are some tricky ones? Potassium is not P, it is K. And S, what is S? Sulfur, not sodium. All right, so these words come from Greek, because in Greek, sodium is really natrium. All right, so sodium is Na in this nomenclature. And potassium is really kalium in Greek, so it helps to speak a number of different languages. Okay, so in that particular case, it's probably all Greek to me. Okay, chemical bonds. Let's talk about some chemical bonds now that we know a little bit about the structure of an atom, for instance. Molecules. What is a molecule? A molecule is when 2 atoms come together and form a complex. So if you just have 1 atom off by itself, that's not really a molecule, that's just an atom. But if we put 2 or more atoms together, we get a molecule. And we put molecules, or we synthesize molecules, by forming bonds between atoms. And the bonds are due to interactions of what? Those valence electrons that are in the outermost shell of an atom. All right, the number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. So if we have, let's see what we got on this slide right over here. Yeah, let's look at this one right here. Here we have an illustration. Let's just pretend that we only have this one atom, not the second atom down over here, only one atom, and I see one proton. What element is that? That's hydrogen. That's easy to find on the periodic table. It's got one electron, but how many electrons are allowed in this outermost shell? There are two. And because there are two electrons necessary to fill up this shell, this hydrogen atom is going to be unstable. It's going to be unhappy. It's only going to be happy when its outermost shell, which is this first one, is completely filled with all the electrons that are allowed, which is how many?
Two.
Right? So this atom is going to look for another electron from somebody to complete this outermost shell. And so it's going to look around and it's going to find another hydrogen atom. And what is this hydrogen atom? What is it looking for? Another electron to fill its outermost shell. And so now these guys are very happy because they will share these electrons. And so both this atom and this one will feel as if its outermost shell is completely filled with electrons, even though we know that they're being shared. And it's a very stable kind of molecule. Okay? Fairly romantic description of chemistry. See, it's not bad. Okay. These are what we call nonpolar covalent. So this is a covalent bond. And what covalent means is that two atoms are going to share electrons. So that's an important key word, sharing. Right? Sharing of electrons is a covalent bond. And of the bonds, of the different kinds of bonds we're going to look at, covalent bonds are the strongest. They contain the most energy. So for instance, if we break this bond, what do we get out of it? A lot of energy. If for some reason we can break it, we get a lot of energy out. But because it's a high energy bond, it's difficult to break. It's fairly stable. Okay, that's a covalent bond. And it's going to be a nonpolar because these electrons are going to be over here or over here the same amount of time. So no matter how you look at this, all right, is this an atom? This whole complex right here, is this an atom or a molecule? Molecule, because it's two atoms put together. So no matter if you look at this molecule from over here, or way over at the wall, or way down over here someplace, or way down over here someplace, it looks the same. And what's the charge on this molecule going to be? It's plus one, plus two, minus one, minus two. So it's going to be absolutely neutral. So no matter how you look at that molecule, it's not going to look like it has any kind of charge because those electrons are zipping around over the nucleus very fast all the time. So because it looks the same, no matter which end you look at, we say it is nonpolar. So you're going to get a feeling, well, gee whiz, maybe there is a polar kind of molecule. Depending on how you look at it, it's going to look differently. And there are polar molecules. Very important part in this class. Okay. Here's another kind of polar molecule. All right, and it is H2O. What is H2O? Everybody knows that. All right, so I tell you what, let's build an H2O molecule just for fun. All right, so who, anybody want to come to the board and build an H2O based on orbital theory? If not, well, let's just do it. I'll do it. Okay. Say that again. Extra credit? For credit on the test, for sure. But you want it will just be a multiple choice kind of question. So we got how many atoms of hydrogen in H2O?
Two.
Two, right? That's what that chemical formula means. H2. There are two hydrogen atoms and how many oxygens? Just one. And that oxygen is going to be in the middle, right? So let's put oxygen in the middle. So here is oxygen. How many protons inside the nucleus of an oxygen? How do we know it's an oxygen atom? How many? I don't know. I got to look. I haven't memorized it. Where's oxygen? Right there. It says 8. Okay. So let's fill these orbitals up. So it's got 8 protons inside the nucleus. Here's the first shell. How many electrons in that first shell? Yeah, 1, 2. And then the next shell, how many can it have? You could have as many as eight, but there isn't enough to go around, right? There's only six left over, so let's put six in here. One, two, three, four, five, six. That's all oxygen has. How many is it missing to fill up that shell? It's missing two. And guess where it can get two from? Hydrogens. It can get two from hydrogen, right? Because hydrogen, what does hydrogen all by itself look like? One proton and? Yeah? Oh, yeah, one electron. Okay, so we can take, so this is hydrogen, right? And that's oxygen. We can take one hydrogen, zip it over here, right? And so this is the one from over here, and with the one proton. Right? And what can happen over here? Another, same kind of thing. So we can have another hydrogen atom come in, donate this electron right over here, and we've got another proton right here, and we've got a what? H1, H2, and an O producing water. Okay. So that's why understanding orbitals is pretty important. Right? And we're gonna create some other little bit more exotic compounds in just a little bit, like ions. Okay, now this water right here, okay, what do I want to say about this? So it's very stable because this outer shell is filled with these two electrons, this proton's outer shell is filled with two electrons, and the outer shell of this oxygen is filled with eight electrons. It's a stable molecule. And what kind of bond? How would you talk about this bond right here? It's covalent bond because what's happening there? Sharing, right? Sharing of electrons, strong bond. Okay. Now, this kind of molecule is very interesting because this nucleus in the oxygen has a lot of positive charges concentrated in this area here. So it has a tendency to suck all of the electronegativity from this hydrogen atom toward the oxygen. So most of the time, this electron from this hydrogen is going to be in this area over here, and it's not going to be out over here someplace. So when you look at a water molecule from this direction, right here, in terms of charge, what do you see first? You don't see any electrons. What do you bump into first? This proton. What's the charge of that proton? It's positive, right? If you look at this water molecule from this direction, how does it look? It's going to look a little positive. But if you count up all the protons and all the electrons over the whole molecule and look at it from far away, what's the charge on it? It's neutral. Okay, but as you get close, it looks charged depending on whether you look from this direction or that direction or some other direction. Overall, it's neutral. Water is not an ion, but it's what we call a polar molecule because different ends have different electrical properties associated with it because of how these orbitals develop. And what did we say about electrical charges? Do they repel each other if they're opposite or attract? If they're opposite, they attract each other. So if we have another water molecule someplace next to this one, will it just take a random orientation or will it order itself? It's going to order itself because if here is another oxygen, okay, with hydrogens right here, these areas here are what? A little bit positive, right? The little squiggle means a little bit. Not as big as one, okay, but a little bit positive. And this area here by the oxygen atom is what? A little bit negative. So this positive area on one water molecule is going to want to associate itself with this little bit negative area of the next water molecule. So water has a lot of structure associated with it, even though it's a liquid. It orders itself because the water molecule is what we call polar. Depending on which end you look at, it has different electrical properties. And that's going to be really crucial for our understanding of how a lot of things work in the body. Okay, polarity. So there are things in your body that are polar. They want to associate with water. There are other chemicals that are nonpolar, and they will have no interest in being around water whatsoever because they're nonpolar. And it all has to do with these orbitals right here. Let me look at this slide. I think this slide right here just kind of shows the same thing. Okay, the oxygen has a little bit of a negative end. These hydrogen atoms here are a little bit positive. Okay. Now I'm going to talk about this dissociation a little bit later. So the atoms that can produce polar covalent bonds are oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus. So when hydrogen is bound to nitrogen and phosphorus, it can behave just like this water molecule, can produce a polar bond. All right. So that's covalent bonds. The next kind of bond, but before I start talking about this one, if you have some questions, now might be a good time, but I don't know if you're familiar enough with this stuff to even ask me a question yet. You're going to have to study over the weekend and come back with some questions, okay? Your book might build other molecules, but I think you'll get a feeling for how to build molecules when we look at this next one here too. Okay? Yeah?
Are you going to ask
you
to draw it out
again? No. I'll ask you, what's happening to electrons in a covalent bond? You're going to say? Sharing. Something's sharing. An ionic bond. What are happening to electrons in an ionic bond? Well, I haven't told you yet, but one atom will donate an electron and another atom will accept that electron. So an electron is actually going to hop from one atom to another atom, and it won't be shared anymore. One is going to completely give it up, and you're going to see why that is in just a second. Okay, so ionic bonds. What the heck is an ion first? Maybe I should tell you what an ion is. For instance, what do we got right here? Na stands for
sodium.
The most neutral form of sodium is when it does not have a charge, but it doesn't like to exist that way in nature, especially in a water solution. It likes to exist as an ion, which means, right, that it carries a little extra charge compared to the negative charges in orbitals. So how many protons inside a sodium element, sodium atom? There are 11 right there. So when it's neutral, how many electrons are in orbitals around it? It's got to be 11, right? But it doesn't exist that way in nature. It exists as what we say as an ion, okay, a plus one ion. That means that it's going to lose an electron. It's going to give away an electron for some reason. And we're going to see why that is in just a second. But that still is a very stable chemical. And we'll see why it's stable in just a second. So this is an ion. So an ion is a molecule or an atom that has a charge on it. It could be a positive charge or a negative charge. That's an ion. And in medicine, if it's an ion, we don't call it an ion necessarily. We call it an electrolyte. So in medicine, we're interested in ions, but we call them electrolytes. And this electro comes from what? They have this charge right here. Some of them are positive electrolytes, some are negative electrolytes. So a lot of times you might have a person in an emergency room or something and everybody's running around and a physician's going to say, we need some lights on this person right away, right, because they're crashing. What does that mean if you're working in the emergency room? You should go get a lamp from someplace and shine it on the patient? That's not what they mean. What they mean is, we need to draw some blood and measure their electrolytes. Everybody just says lights instead of, because you don't have time to say electrolyte, right, when you're really working. All right, so L-Y-T-E is an electrolyte, which means some concentration of sodium and a number of other things. Maybe chlorine, maybe magnesium, right, maybe potassium. Those are all electrolytes. Calcium. All right, so you can see that these electrolytes here have different electrical symbols. Some are positive, some are negative, some have two, some have one charge associated with them. You'll see how that's going to develop. So let me just tell you a little nomenclature, I think, before we go to these ionic bonds. I might have to start next time with this one right here. So which electrons, when we look at covalent bonds, we're interacting with each other? The inner shell or the outer shell? The outer shell. What do we call those electrons in the outer shell? Valence electrons, right? All right, so the same thing for ionic bonds. We're interested in valence electrons, and that's how we talk about these different ions right here. So let's talk about plus and minus first. An ion that has a plus charge is what we call a cation. Okay? And so cation. I have no idea how you're going to know this without memorizing it. This might help. Okay? I don't know why they call it a cation. And then the other kind is an anion. So an anion is what? Negative charge. So a particle that's negatively charged is an anion. A particle that's positively charged is a cation. So for instance, this one right here, chlorine. What is that, cation or anion? That's an anion. What about magnesium 2+? That's a cation. Okay, so cation and anion describe the nature or the polarity of the particle, but it's an incomplete description because both potassium and magnesium are cations, but can you see that there's a difference between them? Sure. This one right here is what we call a divalent what? Cation. This one over here, potassium, is a cation, but what we call a monovalent cation. All right, so that's a nice complete description of that electrolyte. Monovalent, bivalent. That's why we got to know something about valence, a little bit about valence. So what about chlorine? It's an anion, but use the proper terminology. It's what? What kind of anion is it? Monovalent anion. A little wordy, but to completely describe the situation, we have to use those words. Okay? All right. Well, let's get started on this figure. And so what are we looking at? Ionic bonds, not as strong as covalent bonds. They're weaker. Electrons are not shared as they are in covalent bonds. So let's take a look. We're going to build an ionic bond. And we're only interested in what? The valence electrons. One more time. And let's see if I have, do I have an arrow? Oh, good. All right, so here we, oh, I should have erased this. Don't read it. Don't look where I have the cursor. Here we have an element with 11 protons inside the nucleus. What does that have to be? Look at the periodic table. That's got to be what? Who's got 11? That's got to be sodium, which is what? Na, right? All right, so how do we fill up? And when sodium is neutral, it's got to have 11 electrons. How do we fill up the orbitals? 2 in the first one, then 8 in the second one, so that's 10, which means there's 1 left over, and that can't go in the second shell. It's got to be bumped up to the third shell, right? So here's the third shell with how many electrons in it? Just 1. Now, how unhappy is that electron out there all by itself? It should have 8, but there's only 1. So sodium is very unhappy. It wants to get rid of this electron to become stable. Okay, and when it loses that electron, then what's the overall charge of sodium? It becomes plus 1 or a monovalent cation. All right, so that's why sodium is electrolyte and is very stable, because it wants to get rid of that very last valence electron. But for that to happen, there's got to be somebody around that actually wants that electron. And it just so happens chlorine would like to get it. For what reason? How many protons are inside the nucleus of chlorine? Look at the periodic table. Periodic table says chlorine, which is Cl, has got 17 protons inside the nucleus. That's what makes chlorine chlorine. So let's fill those orbitals up. All right, so the first 2, all right, then the next 8, that's 10. So how many are left? 10 minus, there's 7 left. So we got 7 in the outermost shell, but how many electrons should be in the outermost shell to become stable? One more. It's going to look for an electron. It bumps into sodium, and again, a very nice happy circumstance happens because sodium wants to get rid of this electron, chlorine wants to accept it, And when chlorine accepts an additional electron, what's the overall charge of this chlorine atom right here?
Zero.
It's going to be minus one. It's going to be a monovalent anion. Okay, a monovalent anion. All right, so then the sodium ion and the chloride ion will attract each other because opposites attract. All right, but this is a very weak bond. And it can be broken if we take sodium chloride, which is table salt, and even put it in water. There's enough energy in water to dissociate sodium chloride, table salt, that solid, into two separate particles, namely sodium ion and chloride ion. So it's a very, it's a weaker kind of bond compared to a covalent bond. And then lastly, how would we talk about this bond? Are these electrons being shared? No. They're being what? Donated, right, and accepted. So a covalent bond is when electrons are donated and accepted by different atoms, not shared by two atoms. What kind of bond shares electrons? Covalent bond, right. All right, so guess what? It's a lot of fun, but we got to stop. Oh, yeah, the plus, so like calcium right here. It's a cation because it's a positive charge, and it's got two charges on it, so it's a divalent cation. Sodium has one plus charge, so it's a monovalent cation. Yeah, like iron can be trivalent. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've never really heard of quadrivalent anywhere, but there probably are some. There's chromium can have really weird states. There's like a hexavalent chromium. That's not really important biologically, I don't think. But it can be a poison. Hi, that goes to Lynn Selden right there. So your SI forms, give to Ms. Selden, please. Who's right here. Thank you.